Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America, for America.
Newell's got some time off. I'm Dave Cohen. Glad to be with you here on the Newell Norman Show as we head into the afternoon and we watch the skies get a little darker, a few more scattered showers around the region, and we're waiting on potentially flooding rains after 5 o'clock this evening. Keep that in mind as you make your plans today. Also, potential flooding rains tomorrow and then Friday before that cold front is supposed to come all the way through here and give us a beautiful weekend. Once a month, we like to sit down with the New Orleans and Company Hour here on the Newell Norman Show and bring in guests who tell us about some of the great things going on around the city that you may or may not know about and you probably will want to check out. And this month, New Orleans and Company has a fantastic guest for us here in the first half of this hour, Daniel Hammer, CEO of the Historic New Orleans Collection. Daniel, thank you for joining us. I'm Dave Cohen with you on the Newell Norman Show. How you doing?
Hey, Dave. I'm doing great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
You know, we hear a lot about the Historic New Orleans Collection, but I think too many New Orleanians have never, even if they knew that they could, that you have a free museum in the French Quarter where they can come and learn so much about New Orleans, Louisiana, our culture, and our history.
Yeah, that's right. We have a museum in the 500 block of Royal Street. It's free to the public. It's open 6 days a week. And we it's a space where we put on really remarkable exhibitions that are all about the history and culture of our wonderful city and our entire region. We have a collection based that is the world's largest collection of materials relating to the history and culture of New Orleans and the region. And we use this collection of materials to create really engaging exhibitions that we share with the public, with the visitors to our city, and with the residents of our cities right here in the heart of the French Quarter.
And free. I keep hearing that word free.
Yeah, man, say it. Say it again. It's free. It's free. No charge for admission. You know, we offer guided tours and programs for, you know, very modest charges. But the general visit to the museum is free of charge. And, you know, it's not just museum exhibitions. It's a beautiful historic space right in the heart of the French Quarter. We have a wonderful cafe. We have a great shop. You know, there's something for everybody.
And here's our 300-plus-year-old city with such a rich cultural patchwork of history. And to know that we do have somewhere and someone that is keeping track of it all and keeping us grounded and based in our history and our culture, and that it's where we can go and learn a lot more about it. And you have permanent and changing exhibitions that people can experience. So tell us a little bit about, if we go to the Historic New Orleans Collection Museum, what are we going to see? What are we going to experience? What are we going to learn?
Yeah, well, right now we have one really fantastic changing exhibition on view, and we're about to open another. So starting June 6th, there'll be two special exhibitions on view. The first one is called Making It Home, From Vietnam to New Orleans. It is open since April, and it will be open and on view through October 5th of this year. And it is commemorating the 50 years of the Vietnamese community in New Orleans, which was established here after the fall of Saigon in 1975. It's inspired by interviews that we did through an oral history project with some of the original members of that community, people who came here as refugees from Vietnam after the fall of Saigon. And taking together the interviews and the photographs and the objects and the materials in the exhibit provide a history of a vibrant and resilient community. You know, it's very much like our entire community. The Vietnamese community in New Orleans is kind of a metaphor, I think, for our entire community. So it's a beautiful and wonderful exhibit focusing on the hope and the faith and the family of that community. And it's touching, I think, for everybody who calls New Orleans home. In June, we'll be opening the Trail They Blaze, which is likewise built around oral history work initially, and through a collaborative process with people from New Orleans who participated in the local civil rights movement in the mid-20th century. And the Trail They Blaze shows stories of their fight for justice. It's a multimedia, immersive exhibition, and it brings people back to the movement of the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century. It uses musical recordings from the oral histories themselves, and a multitude of photographs and objects to tell a really important story for our nation as it took place here in New Orleans. So that exhibit opens on June 6th. And it will be on view for a year through June 7th of 2026.
And the Making It Home from Vietnam to New Orleans, that's only here through the fall, right? That's going to be.
That's right. So that's only here through October.
Okay.
That's right. And then, so those are our two changing exhibitions. And then we have permanent exhibitions, or we like to call them continuing exhibitions because we're always updating them. But one of them focuses on Louisiana's coastal environment and culture. It's called A Vanishing Bounty. It explores the realities of coastal Louisiana, the challenges that that environment faces with land loss and climate change. And it also looks at it through a cultural lens, exploring the history of the people who've called South Louisiana home and their work and efforts and struggle to continue to thrive culturally in a changing environment. And so that's a wonderful exhibit. It has a lot of really cool and engaging objects. You know, we have, for example, a really important collection of waterfowl carvings, duck decoys, of numbering in the hundreds of objects. And we, continuously update our display of duck decoys. There's about 50 or so of them on view in the exhibit, and we're able to use that exhibit to display these really special carvings. We have a magnificent example of John James Audubon's Birds of America, elephant folio, so the largest size that there is that we display in this exhibit. We've created a wonderful interactive so that you can not just see the one page that we're able to display at a time, but also browse the entire book in a digital form and learn about each of the birds and their migratory paths and hear their calls and a very engaging display of this fantastic American art object.
And hopefully this does not become the only opportunity to experience these things, as we have been fighting the vanishing coastline and the changing ecology of our coastline. But it's great that it is documented, and you can show us the rich history of the coastline and what it has over time had to offer. And maybe that inspired people to want to preserve it and keep it, not only to protect us from hurricanes and to prevent land loss, but also because of the rich natural bounty that it has had over history.
Well, that's right. The natural bounty and the cultural bounty, so much of this exhibition is about the people of South Louisiana and the rich culture that landscape has brought to the world, that we are proud to call our own, and which the entire world is so interested in. We have so many people who come from all over to visit New Orleans every year because they love what we have created over centuries here in South Louisiana, and it speaks to them and it relates to them. And so the exhibit is not just about the challenges of land loss and struggling to maintain our physical environment, but it's also about the beauty of culture and the challenges of preserving that. And so
there's no doubt what we're all about. Yeah, we talk about the loss of land, but we've also lost great populations along the coast of hurricanes and, frankly, because of insurance struggles and people's inability to keep rebuilding because they can't get insurance anymore. So you have these literally vanishing communities of folks who live and work off of the land and provide us with so many wonderful things, but that is a shrinking population, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's also a resilient one. And, you know, I think since I think there's one thing we know well here is that as we're forced to adjust how we live, our culture persists. I think about Katrina and all of the displacement that occurred since Katrina, but also all of the ways that the culture of New Orleans has found ways to manifest itself in new locations, in new places, and in new forms. And so, you know, there is the reality of change, and, you know, preservation of culture is not simply about holding on to the past. It's really about maintaining something through change that is inevitable or unavoidable. So I think that there is a, as it relates to South Louisiana and our challenges, our environmental challenges, you know, we're fighting to hold on to what we can, but we're also, you know, seeing the culture develop as the environment changes.
And from life along the coast to life along the river, you also have one of your continuing exhibitions about life in the French Quarter. Tell us about that.
Right. Sure. Well, you know, the French Quarter is in many ways the heart of New Orleans. It's the part of the city that's been here the longest. It's the original part of the city. And in a way, the entire history of our city is written in its streets and on its buildings. You know, if there's something that was experienced by somebody in New Orleans, there's a part of the French Quarter that can tell that story in some way or another. And so we're very it's very important for us as an institution that this is where we are, that this is where we pursue our activities of cultural and historical stewardship and where we engage the public with them. And so we have an exhibition on permanent view here that focuses on the French Quarter as a place of New Orleans history. It seeks to tell the story of New Orleans through the lens of the French Quarter and its unique characteristics. The people who have lived here, the buildings that are here over the centuries. And so it's very much a story of New Orleans history, but told through the example of the French Quarter.
So the unique characteristics and the unique characters that make up the French Quarter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And, you know, I guess you learned the history of the French Quarter, too, you know, from what was it, a swampy colonial outpost to now one of the oldest neighborhoods anywhere in the United States. That's pretty amazing when you think about a neighborhood that has survived for more than 300 years.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, again, it's the story of preservation as both hanging on to things as they have been, but also seeing how things change and managing change as it occurs. The French Quarter has been here throughout the entire existence of the city, but the activities of the French Quarter and the role the French Quarter plays in the city has changed a lot over those centuries. You know, of course, in the beginning, the entire city was the French Quarter. But over time, activities that were critical to the city moved to different locations. And in fact, about a century ago, the French Quarter was not the most important part of the city in terms of its economics and its population and where they lived. The French Quarter was 100 years ago not fully populated with people, and it was not really a place of interest for most of the kind of economic development ideas and proposals for the city. It was rather a forgotten or underdeveloped area. And, you know, it's in that period in the early 20th century when the founders of our organization, Kemper and Leva Williams, they bought property in the French Quarter because they thought that it was important because it was historic and because it was, you know, charming and beautiful. They weren't alone in thinking that, but they were a couple of a small number of people who thought that way.
That's kind of wild when you, it's kind of wild when you think about it. Around the time of the Industrial Revolution, the French Quarter was not the center of New Orleans like it was before that, and clearly now is afterwards. And that's neat that we can kind of go through that whole historic ebb and flow of the French Quarter there at the historic New Orleans collection. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Daniel about the recent work that they've done over there on the Pope's history and the first American Pope's ties to New Orleans. And we'll also talk about a new exciting project that's going on in the French Quarter through the historic New Orleans collection. After this on W.
Question for our listeners: which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint: it's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence, it's a commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company, from America for America.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
UWL. Daniel Hammer is our guest CEO of the Historic New Orleans Collection. Been telling us about some fascinating free to the public displays, exhibitions at their museum. And recently you all were in the news and I think got worldwide attention because you discovered some very interesting things about the new Pope. What was it, and how did this all come to be?
Yes, so very exciting. Our family historian, Jari Honoré, was the first to reveal, or to uncover and reveal, that Robert Francis Priebus, now Pope Leo XIV, it has a direct connection through his family to New Orleans. So, you know, we have, besides our museum, we do other things here at the Historic New Orleans Collection through our collection. Through our collections. And one of them is we offer them as a research service, access to them for research purposes to the community. So we have a large staff of people who are experts in that, who provide access to the community, to our collections for research, and who themselves are expert researchers. And Jari is a certified genealogist. He's one of only five in the state of Louisiana, and he is a specialist in family histories, especially of the Creole community here in New Orleans. And though he's not limited in his knowledge to that, but he knows a great deal about it. And so when he heard the name Prevost, he's himself a Catholic and was following the conclave closely. And when he heard the name Prevost, he thought, and that he was from Chicago, he thought, Prevost, Chicago, there's got to be a New Orleans connection there. And so, you know, he was able to go to some of his research sources and look and confirm quickly that, in fact, the Pope's maternal grandmother was from New Orleans. She was born in Chicago, but her siblings were born in New Orleans. Her family migrated from New Orleans to Chicago just before she was born. And he was able to identify that they were where they were from in the Seventh Ward of New Orleans, what parish they went to. And he put that out there in the world, you know, and the way everything works now with social media, it was picked up. And the next thing you knew, it was viral. And so we've been since then enjoying a great deal of attention from all around the world. Jari has conducted dozens and dozens of interviews. We've had over 1,000 international and national media placements. Just this weekend, Jari was interviewed on, for example, the CBS Morning Show, and they brought us in to share their social media posting about it. And, you know, they have 500,000 followers. And so it's just been a wonderful example of how the work of cultural stewardship in New Orleans connects with literally millions of people all around the world, because that's the nature of our history here in New Orleans. It's connected worldwide.
And that is fantastic.
It's been really cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's been, that the Pope has family roots here in New Orleans, and they're Creole roots. When a lot of people hear Creole today, I think they think about food. They think about recipes. They think about dishes. But Creole has very important meaning above and beyond the food that grew out of the Creole culture. For the folks who aren't familiar with what Creole truly means, what can you tell us?
Well, you know, Creole is an adjective to describe a culture that is a blended culture that has its roots in both European and non-European cultures and in the colonial world, in the European colonial world. And so Creole, the concept of Creole and that sort of blending of cultures is as diverse as European colonial endeavors. It exists literally all over the world. Here in Louisiana, it refers to the pre-American period of Louisiana. So people and practices which trace back to before the Louisiana Purchase in Louisiana and have European connectivity are can be described as Creole. And so some of these, that can be a combination of European and Native and African and Caribbean cultures coming together here in Louisiana to produce the things that we know. And those things can be food. It can be gumbo. It can be Cajun food as well. You know, Cajun is a type of Creole. It's a specific type of Creole, but it is similarly a blending of cultures taking place in Louisiana, originating in different places around the world and coming together here. It can be food, it can be art, it can be many things.
And as best you were able to determine, the Pope's maternal grandmother was Creole, and she was of Black descent.
Right. So they were her family were descended from free people of color who came to Louisiana, who left Louisiana for a time and went to Haiti and then came back to Louisiana. And so it was and before the end of the Civil War, they were free people of color. So that was a category of people that was a very important part of the New Orleans is a very important part of New Orleans' history and is connected to many of the things that we love about New Orleans culture. And so that the Civil War, once emancipation took place, the category of free person of color ceased to be a legal category, if you will, but it continued to be a cultural reality in terms of the descendants of free people of color continuing to live in New Orleans and to participate actively, civically and culturally in New Orleans, up until today in many different ways. And so the Prevost family was among that group. And you know, like many people in that community, they left New Orleans when the Jim Crow segregation and practices made life here difficult to the point of being intolerable. And in some cases also, people chose to pass as white. So that also is a part of the history. You know, some descendants of free people of color live their lives as people of color. Some descendants of free people of color made the choice to lived their lives as white people, which involved a great deal of strife and family separation, because it was really, in many ways, required a break with family and acquaintances and the past. And so it's a very complex and complicated history, but it is important for our nation and, you know, for New Orleans. And I think it's just really a point of pride for us that that story, which relates to our community so dearly, is now held in the family history of the Pope himself.
Yeah, the historic New Orleans collection telling the world that the Pope had these roots, that his grandmother was indeed a black woman. And I think that it shed a lot of light on the Creole history of New Orleans and is fascinating to many. And it's not just the Pope you can find out about at the historic New Orleans collection. You can actually do all kinds of research there on genealogy and other things throughout history here in New Orleans, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, you don't have to be the Pope to learn about your genealogy at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Anybody is welcome. we're very proud to do everything we can to make our collections accessible to people as much as possible. And so our research center, which is also located in the French Quarter on Charter Street, is in fact open to the public 5 days a week, and no appointment is necessary. And we make also a great deal of materials available as much as possible through our website, hnoc.org, through research tools there, like an online catalog and other databases and other things that can help people do research. We also welcome people's inquiries by phone or email. You can email us at reference@hnoc.org with your questions, and our staff of researchers and librarians and archivists We'll get back to you and help you navigate our collections and advise also about other resources beyond our walls that might help with your research, depending on, you know, what you're looking for. So,
and I'm also fascinated that
part of what we do,
that your facility at 416 Charter Street, that's the old K. Paul's Louisiana Kitchen. And
yep, so
that's
the
fantastic.
The research center's at 410 Charters, and then right next door, the old K. Paul's, 416. We're currently renovating it. I was just walking through there this morning with our CFO and capital project manager.
Can you still smell the blackened redfish?
Well, there's a little bit of a smell of primer on the new sheetrock walls in there right now, so it might be masking it. But I bet that blackened redfish smell is going to come back. You know, one cool feature of the building is I don't know if you remember, but they had on the door handles were brass peppers.
Yes.
And they had to take them down when they left the building, you know, not wanting them to get stolen, but we still have them and we're going to be putting those back on. And, you know, we have a great relationship with our friends at Magic Seasoning Blends, which is Paul Prudhomme's you know, spice company, which continues to exist today. And they're supportive of some of our food related programming that we do. And they're just thrilled that we acquired the building. And we're looking forward to keeping Chef Paul's legacy alive in the future.
All right. Now I want jalapeno cornbread, but
I know I miss that restaurant. I'll tell you what, it was a great place to have right next door.
So many amazing memories at K. Paul's.
Yes, sir.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the great things going on with the historic New Orleans collection and how people can research their own genealogy and come and experience the history of New Orleans and the rich fabric of the culture of New Orleans and the surrounding region as well. Thank you for joining us here on WWL.
All right. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to talk to the CEO of the National World War II Museum as we continue with our New Orleans and Company show here on the Newell Norman Show and talk about what they're planning. Can you believe that the National World War II Museum, originally the D-Day Museum, opened 25 years ago? I so vividly remember being there with Tom Hanks and Tom Brokaw and probably a lot of other Toms, but many other people as well, and the parade and everything else to open that museum. Such a magical day 25 years ago. Now they're going to try to commemorate that. We'll find out how after this on WWL.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company, from America for America.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Next week will mark 25 years since the opening of what was the National D-Day Museum, now the National World War II Museum. I so vividly remember being there that day for the parade of heroes of World War II veterans, along with the likes of Tom Hanks, Stephen Ambrose, Tom Brokaw, Steven Spielberg. And I'm guessing Stephen Watson was there. He's the CEO of the National World War II Museum and joins us here on WWL. Wow, that was 25 years ago?
I know. It's hard to believe, right? And, you know, we've been reflecting a lot in the last few months about, you know, that magnificent opening. And, you know, we used to say it was the biggest non-Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans until the Saints won the Super Bowl. But it was just a remarkable week of events. And I just think a launching point for the museum. And almost immediately, you know, the board, you know, took on that larger vision of going from D-Day to telling the whole story of World War II. And we really haven't stopped, you know, since that opening day 25 years ago.
And the footprint of the museum has grown so dramatically, and the offerings that you have at the National World War II Museum over the last 25 years. And yeah, I'm still marveling. June 6th will be 25 years. So what are you planning to commemorate the 25th anniversary of this New Orleans treasure?
So we really kick things off in the next couple of days with our American Spirit Awards. And you know, really, I think there's three things that we want to accomplish in the next 10 days. Is one, I think this might be the last big public opportunity to recognize and thank surviving members of the World War II generation. So that's sort of a critical component of what we're going to do.
How many World War II vets do you think are left?
50,000. And that may sound like a lot, but if you consider that 16.1 million men and women put on an American uniform in World War II. 50,000 is, you know, less than one-third of 1%. So, you know, the youngest veterans at this point are 100 years old or thereabouts. So, you know, we have precious few moments left in a public way with attention on the museum and our mission to thank them. So that is one part of what we will do in the next week throughout a number of events. The other part is, I think, really thanking the early supporters and the leaders that got us to this point, and I'll talk about that in a second. And then the last thing, I think, is we got to look to the future, and we got to talk about what's next, because I believe there's more important work to be done, and I believe we'll never have done enough. So we're going to also use this anniversary as an opportunity to, you know, talk about what's to come. So, but we'll kick all of that off tomorrow with our American Spirit Awards, and we'll honor three really amazing Americans that have just led amazing lives and done so much for our museum. Boise Bollinger, our major donor to the museum with his wife Joy, the chairman that led us through the transition from the D-Day Museum to the World War II Museum, still very active on the board. Paul Hilliard, a World War II veteran. He was a tail gunner in a SBD Dauntless dive bomber, flew 45 missions in the Pacific, has been on the board here for 20 years, was our chair 5 years ago, going through the tough times of COVID, and just being an amazing benefactor, and having a World War II veteran with you on this journey on the board is something very special. And last, but certainly not least, the person that I credit as the most important person in getting the museum open 25 years ago and everything since is Nick Mueller, who is just a remarkable man whose vision and tenacity is I think, largely responsible for the institution that we are today. So we'll honor them this weekend.
That starts tomorrow. And then
starts tomorrow and Friday. And then next week, we'll have a series of public events. Nick has written a book called Preserving the Legacy that really tells the story of how this museum has come together over the last 25 years. And we'll do a book launch on June 5th. He produced a book with LSU Press, and we will launch that here at the museum. And then on D-Day itself, June 6th, we will start with an HR ceremony at 6:30 in the morning. At 11 o'clock, we'll have our D-Day ceremony, the Hal Baumgarten D-Day ceremony at 11, where we'll, of course, commemorate the 81st anniversary of D-Day, celebrate our 25th anniversary. And that will be one of the focal points to really cherish the members of the World War II generation that are with us. And that's where we'll also talk about the future, and we'll talk about the vision for the next decade and what's to come. And then that night, we've got a really special performance with the Louisiana Philharmonic at the Orpheum and historian John Monsky. It's an orchestral performance and a multimedia experience that really chronicles that last year of the war in Europe, from D-Day to VE Day. It's really kind of a very special, one-of-a-kind performance. So that will kind of be a really nice way to end D-Day. And then the following day, on Saturday, we'll have a family and Veterans Day, where it's free for the military, free for veterans, free for kids, and really a celebration on our campus to kind of cap off that 25th anniversary week.
Talking with Stephen Watson, the CEO of the National World War II Museum, as they approach their 25th anniversary. You know, I was talking to a veteran this week about Memorial Day, and they were bemoaning the fact that they feel like Memorial Day has lost a lot of its meaning on particularly the younger generations, and how the world doesn't know the threat of an international force that threatens our democracy, threatens our freedom the way that the generations did during and after World War II, and that we may have amnesia about the fact that how special our freedoms are. And the World War II Museum plays a vital role in making sure we never forget the dangers of the world that are out there and the importance of our freedoms and protecting them.
That's absolutely right. And, I always say that Memorial Day is the day that I feel closest to the mission. We had a remarkable ceremony here on Monday. Gail Joyce, whose son James Casey Joyce was killed in Somalia in Mogadishu in 1993. If you've seen the movie Black Hawk Down, he was one of the Army Rangers that was killed in that exercise. And she came and talked about the pain of losing a 24-year-old son and hearing that very personal testimony, and she also lost her husband, a Vietnam veteran, years after the conflict to complications from exposure to Agent Orange. So we had a packed house here, and I think when you hear that personal testimony, it really touches you in a way where you reflect on the importance of our work. And our last pavilion that we opened 18 months ago, Liberation, I think really connects all the dots and gets to the meaning of why World War II was and is still so significant, because I think our victory in World War II and the outcomes of that and why that's relevant is that it preserved and promoted freedom and democracy and human rights across the world. And, we often thank veterans for their service and their sacrifice, and I always say we should also thank the World War II veterans for winning. Because their victory in World War II changed the course of history. and was a victory for freedom and democracy. And I think the outcomes of the war and that post-war era is an important part of the story and the legacy of the war, and has shaped the world that we live in for the last 80 years. So
no doubt.
That is the so what of our mission. I think that's what we will all talk about 100 years from now when we reflect on the importance of World War II.
Yeah, had the Allies, the United States leading that effort not been successful, you and I, I doubt we would be talking today in this sort of a setting, and that we would be enjoying the freedoms that we have right now, unless we had seen that victory. And it is great that you are there preserving that so the generations will understand how important it is that we fight for freedom, even at a time when maybe it's not as threatened as it once was. It's great that we're not under those threats now, but we can't forget that we once were and could be again. And also thank you for the fact that you have taken an area of the city of New Orleans. We were talking earlier on the program about blight. You've taken a portion of the city of New Orleans that desperately needed help and made it an economic hub. And you continue to expand year after year your footprint of the National World War II Museum, and are not only a cultural engine and a historic engine, but also an economic one for our city.
Yeah, and we're very proud of that. You know, I think 85% of the people that come and visit our museum come from out of state, and a majority of them come to New Orleans because of the museum. So what does that mean? That means on average, on any given night, we are filling more than 1,000 hotel rooms in this city with destination travelers who've come to New Orleans with their primary reason for visiting is a visit to the museum. So, yeah, the neighborhood has transformed, the campus has transformed, the economic impact is close to $3 billion at this point since opening. We have over 500 people that work on this campus, almost 400 volunteers. This is a big and complex place that we believe is doing incredibly important work, but has had this huge, I think, impact on the neighborhood, and I would like to thank tourism in the city, and we got more to come. You know, we are getting ready to build another pavilion here on Magazine Street. There will be a support center for our collections and our exhibits. We're going to open a leadership training center so that we can have more residential programs for high school students all the way through corporate executives. So we've got a lot of work still to do, and I believe, you know, the best days for our museum are still ahead of us.
Stephen Watson, I'll just end it with this. Thank you. We appreciate it, and we look forward to this week's worth of 25th anniversary events. We're back after this. Scoot, what you got coming up?
Well, we'll talk about some controversial pardons from the President of the United States. And also, you know, we got news yesterday that rock icon Rick Derringer passed away. You know, his name might not mean a lot to you, but he really touched many of our lives in many ways that we didn't even know. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I was fascinated when I started to hear not only about his hits, but who he's worked with since.
Yes, wow. Yeah, it's impressive.
All right. Well, you'll be working with Scoot for the next 3 hours. He's in. I'll be back at 5 a.m. here on WWL.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America, for America.